This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Size your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Galina Limarenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at BFL in Switzerland, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Chiara Marletto about her new book, The Science of Can and Can't, a physicist's journey through the land of counterfactuals. What if there was an entirely new way to consider the laws of physics which could deliver the next scientific revolution? This is the first book to be published on the new science of counterfactuals, which is being led by a team in Oxford University pioneered by David Deutsch and Chiara Marletto. A radically different approach to physics is currently being hotly pursued by the author and other researchers in top universities around the world. It is the science of counterfactuals, or, if you like, of hypotheticals. Taking us beyond the assumptions and boundaries of Newtonian laws, this new approach to physics asks what a thing could do and measure that outcome, allowing scientists to imagine a whole new suite of questions and answers about what is possible and what isn't within the laws of physics. Marletto guides us through this new landscape, theme by theme, interspersing nonfiction science with fictionalized stories that elaborate their meaning and give the reader time to reflect. Well, Chiara, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you with us today. So as we have witnessed the unprecedented times of the global pandemic, well, in the middle of which we're still currently are really, could you perhaps reflect on how has it affected you and your work, and maybe some main takeaways that you have gathered from the experience?
So my work is mostly theoretical. So I do my work with pencil and paper and a computer. So in that sense, the pandemic hasn't affected very negatively my work. In fact, I've had, in a sense, more time for thinking and for, you know, doing reading on the side and so on. So in that sense, I've been very lucky. I've had some setbacks with experimental collaborators because they actually had a very, you know, negative effect on their own work in the sense that they couldn't go in the lab for a long time. So in that sense, some things have slowed down. But on the whole, I think my category, theoretical physicists, haven't been that negatively affected by the whole business. I have to say, I mean, the major takeaways from the pandemic, and the most striking thing for me was this fact that we had to, as you know, as a whole, thinking about the whole of humanity, we had to very quickly think on our feet in order to, you know, solve a problem that we were not prepared for. And I think in this sense, I was really stunned by the way in which, you know, the vaccine research was, you know, just very quickly put together to provide a very, very strong and useful response in the form of creating, you know, very effective set of vaccines that were the way out of this problem, really. And hopefully they are actually getting us out now. So in that sense, I think it was an interesting thing to witness how, you know, knowledge creation has been like a major factor in trying to sort out this huge problem of the virus. And it was quite nice to see also different new ways of creating a vaccine, such as, you know, these RNA-based vaccines being commercialized basically in a very, very short time by cutting through various admin, red tape, which, you know, wouldn't have been possible in normal times. So that was possibly a good side effect of this whole terrible business.
Yes, for sure, cutting on a bit of a bureaucracy. So can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
As I said, I'm a theoretical physicist. So my, my work is mainly trying to figure out how some very basic phenomena at the foundations of physics work. And I'm particularly interested in quantum physics and in quantum information, which is basically the theory of how, you know, computers can run on quantum systems. And specifically, I've been interested in trying to go beyond the quantum theory of computation with a program which is called the Constructor Theory Program. And that's kind of the focus of my research. And I've been working on it with various collaborators, including David Deutsch, who was the kind of proponent of this approach. He started the whole program while I was actually a PhD student. And I think that's when I started working myself on the topic. And then I advanced it and applied it to various different areas of fundamental physics. So that's, let's say, the focus of my work. And more broadly, I think I enjoy, I'm kind of interested in a number of other things to do with epistemology and theoretical biology. I quite like literature in general. So I have a number of other sort of side interests that I'm trying to cultivate as I'm doing physics.
Were you always interested in sciences since you were a child, or did you get inspired along the way?
I think my parents somehow, especially my father, had this, scientific bent in a way. But in a sense, we were all discussing, you know, these things like how some curious phenomena that you can see in your home can be explained through physics. But I think my fascination with physics started quite late in a way, maybe when I was a teenager. So 15, 16. And it blossomed during the university time when I actually realized that actually theoretical physics was really very fundamental and had a universal take on physical reality. I think this idea of looking for universality in statements is one thing that fascinates me very much. And this is why earlier on, I think when I was a younger teenager and maybe a child, I was really into literature on the one hand and philosophy. So I think I liked the fact that these two disciplines seemed to, you know, try to address these general problems that are universal for the whole of humanity, if you like. And then I realized that actually physics does an even better job at tackling universal questions, because they're not just universal for the whole of humanity, but they're actually universal for everything in the universe. And, you know, can't get better than that, I would say. So that's how I got into physics.
So along your journey towards where you are now in the physics field, how welcoming did you find the whole environment, and what roles did the mentors play? And I wonder if you maybe would have some advice to our young and especially female scientists who might be a bit hesitant in entering theoretical physics.
I had a very good experience personally. So I'm talking by experience, and I think my own trajectory was just perhaps remarkably lucky in the sense that I started with a degree that was very much dominated by males. So in a sense, that perhaps was initially, you could say, slightly, something that would intimidate me slightly. But I think I never thought that there was a problem, and I really just went on based on my own interests and never trying to relate to the world around me more like as an individual rather than through a particular gender narrative. And in that way, perhaps because I was lucky, I somehow never found particularly unwelcoming environments around me towards, women. So I didn't feel this negative bias that I think I've heard some other colleagues of mine who are also females had. So in that sense, I was lucky. But I think one key thing was that my mentors were very much empowering me as an individual. So again, this started, in fact, with my parents, both my father and my mother, who somehow never hinted at the fact that my performance in intellectual activities could be affected by the fact that I was a girl. And later on, I think my mentors in physics were just very supportive, and they somehow treated me, as I said, as an individual interested in something, as an expert. And I think through this, you really relate to your subject in this direct way without going through this particular gender narrative. And I think this is very liberating. So in that sense, I think my advice for maybe my younger self would be to do exactly what I did, in a sense of focus on what really fuels your passion, and approach the environment in this way as an expert in a particular field that you want to master in the end. And, no doubt you will find issues and problems as always. But I think if you approach the world in this way, in an open way, there's always a way to find a path around these problems. And I think this is also a key to kind of improve this situation with women in science in a way, because, we really, as women, we need to set the trend and to show that actually we are absolutely as good as, any other physicist. And the only way to do this is really to approach the subject in this completely unbiased way, in a way that you're just interested in something and you try to pursue it as well as you can.
Oh, this is so inspiring to hear, especially for our female and other scholars from underrepresented groups as well. So you bring all of your really deep expertise and also your passion for your topic together in this excellent book, The Science of Can and Can't. So can you tell us, what is it about and how did you come to writing it?
So the book is about a radically new way to formulate laws of physics. And it's inspired by this work that I've been doing, as I said, initially jointly with David Deutsch, who actually proposed the approach that's called constructive theory. And the science of Kant and Kant is the poetic name for this approach that I use in the book. So the way this approach works is that it takes a philosophy that's become very important within the field of quantum information, where we have learned that the essence of quantum physics can be expressed through statements about what transformations are possible, what are impossible, and why, as opposed to what traditionally is done in physics, where you state laws in terms of laws of motion, a bit like Newton's laws, and the initial conditions for these dynamical laws. And so the idea is to take this approach and extend it to the whole of physics in much the same way that, for example, thermodynamics has done. So I think if you think of the way in which physics is formulated, very broadly speaking, traditionally you have basically that the most fundamental statements are really just these descriptions of how objects move in space and time. Mm. And so these are just trajectories, if you like, of objects. And you can do this with small objects like particles. Then you can try to look at more macroscopic objects, such as, for example, ourselves, if you like. And then you can enlarge your system up to the level of the universe. And the hope, the holy grail for traditional physics is to find the ultimate law of motion that tells you how the whole universe actually moves in space and time, given some initial conditions. And the narrative in physics is that once you have this law, you've explained everything there is to explain. However, there are some exceptions to this philosophy, and I think to this approach. And one major exception is, as I said, thermodynamics. So in that field, when you want to describe why, for example, a certain thermal engine can work in a certain way and not another, and why, for example, you can transform only a certain amount of heat into work with certain sound effects, you appeal to statements like the second law of thermodynamics, which is about impossibility. So the second law of thermodynamics says that some perpetual motion machines are impossible. Mm. And this is a statement that's much more general than any particular trajectory, because it really holds for all trajectories. And it one go actually rules out a whole set of trajectories for the universe where actually perpetual motion machines exist. And so this science of Kant and Kant tries to generalize this approach, which, as I said, is very powerful within thermodynamics, but also in quantum information theory, in a way that can enlarge the set of methods that we use in theoretical physics to tackle questions that at the moment we are not able to capture completely within physics. So some such questions are about the physics of living systems. Other questions are about the thermodynamics of the very, very small scales. Heat engines that work at the nanoscale, not just macroscopic ones that power our trains and cars and so on. And other questions are about the information theory of theories that go beyond quantum theory itself, towards the domain of quantum gravity, for example. And we are hoping that these new tools that the science of Kant and Kant provides can help us capture more of physical reality within fundamental physics than it's currently possible to do. And the way I got to write the book is that I started working on this, as I said, with David when I was doing my PhD. I think I met David and in Oxford, and then we started a collaboration, which was very fruitful. And then I developed some of the aspects of the theory on my own, and also I had to defend it and explain it to many people, both in the physics community, but also there was an interest from biology and an interest from even the general public. And somehow I developed a number of written pieces where I was trying to explain these ideas to myself as well as to other people in the most, far-reaching way that I could. And because, since I write, I actually like writing, it was very easy to try to move from there to actually writing a real book. And I think, that was how it happened. And so that's how the idea of a book came about. And I then moved on to actually write the book, which I really enjoyed because, as I said, I quite enjoy writing in general. And it was a very interesting exercise, something different from writing about physics in the technical sense, but very useful as an intellectual journey, I think, as you understand better things because you are explaining them in simple terms, you seem to go deeper into a subject that you thought you knew, but actually you didn't know as well as you thought.
Yes, for sure. And the book really retains this character that you and you convey very complex topics in a very approachable manner. So let's dive in a little bit more deeply into the science part. So you already mentioned that there is the conventional way we view physics of motion. So what are some of the shortcomings of the current theories that you try and address?
So one major shortcoming is that, as I said, when you try to do physics in the traditional way, what you want to have is a low motion for systems so that you can go in the lab and given some initial conditions for a given system, for example, I don't know, the famous, apple that fell on Newton's head, you can then say what is the trajectory that this particular object will follow once it's set in that particular initial condition. So, the apple can fall from the tree and then hit Newton's head, or it can be thrown at Newton's head. And in all of these cases, it's important to set the initial conditions of the apple because that's what tells you where the trajectory starts. And then the laws of motion that Newton thought about unfold. And this logic is followed also by general relativity as well as by quantum theory, which are the two most fundamental theories of physical reality we currently have and that have superseded Newton's laws themselves. Now, the problem here is that when you try to extend this logic to the universe, of course, you need initial conditions for the universe as well. But it's very hard at present to give such initial conditions. So there are some theories that physicists have proposed for the initial conditions of the universe, but they are not fundamental and as thought through as, say, quantum theory and general relativity are. And so they are at odds with the laws of physics that we currently hold as the best explanations of the physical reality. And moreover, it's very hard to test them. So we are a little bit in this dark situation where to follow through this traditional approach, which wants to give a dynamical law for everything, including the initial conditions, we have to give the initial conditions for the universe. But it's very hard to get a good theory going for these initial conditions. And so the principles that the sense of canon Kant appeals to, since they are about possible and impossible transformations on subsystems of the universe, we are hoping to be able to use them in order to constrain indirectly these theories of the initial conditions, thereby going past and bypassing this problem of what are the initial conditions of the universe. So in a way, this major shortcoming of the current approach, which is how do we set the initial conditions of the universe, should be solved by this new approach because we can explain the choice of initial condition in terms of these new principles. So that's one thing. Then there is another problem with the current approach. And the problem is that somehow there are some phenomena that don't fit into this narrative of trajectories, no matter how hard you try. And some of these phenomena, as I said, are related to the physics of life, and others are related to the physics of information. And I think a very good example for this is this usual example that I like to give, which is, let's say you ask me, why is it that a given transistor in a computer is off at a certain time during a computation? Now, the one way to answer that question is to say, well, it's off because the initial conditions of the computer were such that in a different region of the hardware, other transistors were on or off at the start of the computation. So that's one way of answering. And of course, it mimics this traditional approach to physics because it's all about trajectories of transistors and interactions between them and then their initial conditions. But there is a different answer that I can give you. And this answer could be, well, it's off because it's the end of the computation and the computer was programmed to factor a number, and the initial number was 15, and now that transistor, which is off, encodes the number 5, which is one of the factors of 15. Hmm. And now this is a different explanation, you see, and it doesn't use trajectories or initial conditions, but it refers to what could have been, what other outputs and inputs you could have had to the computer and to the program that happens to be running on the computer. So it refers to a number of possibilities. And these possibilities are the kind of possibilities that the science of Kenneth Kant is all about. And it turns out, actually, this is not just a fluke of this example, but all of the physics of information can be perfectly and exactly expressed within this approach of counterfactuals. So statements that refer to possible and impossible transformations. And on the other hand, it's very poorly expressed with statements about trajectories of objects in space and time. And so by switching to counterfactuals as your basic things for laws of physics, you can capture information exactly. And it's not just information, it's quantum information as well. And then the physics of life, which is based on information processing, as well as other aspects of thermodynamics. So it's a very simple switch, but I think it can address this issue with some fields of the traditional approach of to physics, which currently can at best express some of these phenomena that we haven't quite incorporated into physics, and we want to do better. We want to have laws that are exact about these phenomena, even though they are regarded traditionally as approximate and emergent in the traditional conception of physics.
So how can this counterfactual approach be applied to concepts such as quantum computing or energy conservation?
These concepts are already counterfactual in nature somehow. They are already informally approached within physics in a counterfactual way. It's just that this is not acknowledged usually. So it's a bit of a counterfactual approach in denial, if you like. So starting with quantum computation or quantum information, the basic step of quantum information is to recognize that there are some aspects that are shared by all quantum systems. And these aspects are, so irrespective of whether the quantum system is a photon or an electron or, a neutrino or some other particle that is quantum mechanical and has some features that are different from the others. So all of these particles obey some general principles that are about how they can process information. And this is the key intuition that the founding fathers of the quantum computer had in the 80s and 90s. And somehow this is already counterfactual in nature because the basic thing that these systems cannot do is stated already by the famous Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So this principle says that a quantum system, doesn't matter what its details are, must have at least two properties, two physical properties like velocity and position of an electron, for example, that cannot be observed or measured with arbitrarily high accuracy simultaneously by the same device. So, you know, classically, you can think of a huge device where if you just insert a particle with some properties, this device can measure all of the properties of this particle and tell you with arbitrarily high accuracy what the values, actual values of these properties are. With a quantum particle, you can't create such a machine. It's impossible. And if you could, then you would violate the laws of quantum theory. And this is the key to explain how a qubit, which is the elementary, the most elementary information unit for a of a quantum system, differs from a classical unit, which is the bit. So a qubit is a system that can be a bit in many different inequivalent ways, but all of these ways can be jointly observed or measured. And so this generalizes the idea of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And if you think about it, this principle, which is at the core of quantum theory and of quantum information, is actually a counterfactual principle because it's about impossibilities. And then it becomes even more interesting because when you take two qubits together, the fact that you cannot perform some transformations on each of them, which is stated by the Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, allows you to have more possibilities on the joint systems of these two qubits. So, for example, you can have things like entanglement, which is a special kind of correlation that only quantum systems have. And then you can have, because of entanglement, cryptography, different schemes to create a secure way of sending information based, in fact, on entanglement and therefore on the Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, and so on. So I think the essence of quantum information is actually counterfactual. And the reason why this is important is that when we are trying to understand what the successor of quantum theory will be in the context of finding, for example, a quantum theory of gravity, we need to have some general principles that are independent of the particular details of quantum theory that can capture the foundations of quantum theory and the aspects that will survive once quantum theory is replaced with a new theory. And quantum information theory and its counterfactual extension that I'm envisaging with this research program is devised exactly to do this. So it can tell you what are the resilient, robust features of quantum systems that will still be there once we have discovered the successor of quantum theory. And so the conjecture is actually that things like entanglement and quantum superpositions and all of these phenomena that are at the base of quantum information processing power will still be viable in the new theory and will still conform to these general patterns of possibility and impossibility, even though they will be described with different equations and different dynamical laws. And this is how the principles of the science of can and can't more generally can guide us maybe to guess the next theory of physics.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This is fascinating. And what about the concept of universality? Do counterfactuals also apply?
Yes. So the concept of universality is very it's a very powerful idea that was it was hinted at by already in the writings of this mathematician that worked in the Victorian times, Ada Lovelace. She worked with Babbage, who was was the inventor of the first programmable computer ever known, at least in these modern times. So Babbage and Lovelace worked together to create what would have been the first programmable computer. Sadly, it was never actually realized, but I think Ada Lovelace wrote in her notes that this machine could be programmed to effectively simulate anything, any motion that is allowed in the universe. And I think this is the gist of the idea of universality that was then, fully explored by Alan Turing with, of course, her universal Turing machine. And later on by Deutsch, who actually was the person who pioneered the idea of universality within the quantum computer by proposing a scheme for the quantum universal computer. And the key idea of universality is really counterfactual because it's about the fact that with given resources, a suitable set of say elementary interactions between subsystems can, so bits or qubits, if you like, can simulate to arbitrarily high accuracy any motion that is possible in the universe. And this is an interesting thing. So, if you look at some dynamical equations, I don't know, for example, quantum theories, and then you say, well, these dynamical equations describe how a dog works. And, well, universality says that it's possible to construct, to program a universal Turing machine to execute the motion of the atoms that compose the dog any given accuracy. So, if I tell you I wanted the simulation of the dog to be accurate to this degree, you can find a program to do that. And then if I tell you, no, actually I want a better dog, a more accurate dog simulation of the dog, you can find an even better program to do that and so on. And this is a very non-trivial thing. It's a very non-trivial property of the laws of physics. It's a conjecture principle, if you like, that all good laws of physics should be like that. And as I said, this could serve also as a guideline, if you like, for conjecturing future laws of physics in the same way that thermodynamics, for example, the second law, has always guided us when we were trying to think of how to refute some proposed laws of physics in the past. And the idea is that these new laws about information could actually, based on counterfactuals, could actually serve the same purpose and make us even more well-equipped to guess future laws of physics.
So you spell out very clearly why this new radical approach to physics may be necessary. So what would be next steps to be taken to actually incorporate counterfactuals into the physics field? How difficult or how easy do you think this could be?
So I think this is a program and it will take some time to develop it to its full extent. And one thing that we have been doing is to conjecture some of these new principles based on counterfactuals and then try to find connections between these new principles and experimental consequences, which is, of course, the way in which we want to go, because we'd like to be able to test these new laws. Yeah, and recently I think there was a nice proposal to test quantum effects in gravity, which I put forward together with a collaborator of mine in Oxford, Vlatko Vedro, and then a different team in London, led by Sugato Bose, also proposed in a slightly different form. And these two proposals that to test quantum effects in gravity, so therefore things that are very close to, if you like, experimental verification, can be underpinned by some of these principles about information theory that you can express within the science of can and count or constructor theory. And this is nice because this fact gives a robust underpinning to these tests, which is something that we as physicists find always very exciting, because the game is always to try to find conclusions that are as robust and strong as they can be. And somehow the fact that an experiment is based on foundations that are not dependent on specific details of laws of motion, but only on these general counterfactual principles, is a very good thing. And so one step forward is to find more examples of this kind where, you know, you can get a, so to speak, a killer application out of these principles that you wouldn't be able to guess without them. So that's one important way forward. The other important way forward is to find mathematical tools to express the theorems that we proved and also the future theorems in a more general way, and possibly to discover in even broader versions of the theory that we have so far created. So in a sense, this is a bit like having being at the start of the era of the theory of computation. So at the start of what say Turing was doing, and not having fully developed the whole set of mathematical tools that you need to express this theory. So we are in a similar situation now where some of these principles are formulated with mathematical tools that are perhaps a bit rudimentary. So they are based on set theory and various other things of that sort. But for example, there could be better expressions of them perhaps in category theory or in more powerful algebraic tools that you can find in current mathematics. So I think that's another direction in which I see a lot of development potentially could come. And finally, I think the other important thing would be to show how the principles of constructor theory can be used in order to constrain the initial conditions for the theory of the initial conditions for the dynamical laws that we currently have. So I think that's an important step, because so far we've proven that the science of can and count is compatible with quantum theory, and it's compatible with also classical physics, at least in the non-relativistic sense, and we are hoping to be able to extend it to also being compatible with relativity. But it would be very nice to be able to then derive some interesting constraints from the principles on the dynamical laws, rather than just showing that the principles are compatible with the dynamical laws that we currently know. So I think that's the third next step. And I'm trying to work on these together with some collaborators. And I think kind of there is a growing momentum around these issues. And so we're hoping to have more progress soon.
So from purely intellectual perspective, all of this is really exciting, but many might find it a little bit ephemeral, really, and not really think that this could be practically useful. So I was just wondering if you have some ideas on what would be the most likely, even practical applications, something analogous to, for example, GPS, which of course uses the concepts from a very basic research.
Yes, I think this is a nice question because it touches on an issue which is somehow something that we theoretical physicists always, in some sense, have at the back of our minds. So every theory that is kind of fundamental, so it's very deep in some sense. So it's kind of examples of these theories are, if you like, quantum theory or general relativity or Maxwell's theory of light, and so on, appears to be that all of these theories are usually very far from specific applications, and usually, they might. So someone who is working on developing them might appear as simply following some inner interest with, based on some quest for, I don't know, unifications or trying to understand a specific phenomenon better. But it's always hard to make a link between these type of problems, which are fundamental, and a specific technological application, which may actually come out once you solve these problems. A similar thing happened with Turing's theory, if you like, and in a smaller proportion with the quantum theory of computation. And I think I talked to lots of people who worked in the early days of the quantum theory of computation, where, for example, when David wrote his first paper on the universal quantum computer, that really looked like a curiosity that, most people within computer science, but also physics, were very skeptical of, and they were thinking that it could be like a philosophical curiosity, but, how could it be connected to applications? And then, step by step, I think with the work of, many years and many other people, there was a clear connection shaping up between that theoretical original proposal and the proposal of other people like Feynman, Benioff, and Charlie Bennett, and so on, and this whole enterprise of quantum technologies that we now almost treat as an established commercial application. So in this sense, I think this is a general feature of ideas that are very fundamental. And so the fact that they are far away from applications at first is actually a good sign in a sense, because either they turn out to be wrong, but in an interesting way, and so this is actually something that opens up a new line of inquiry, or if they turn out to be right, then they actually will have very, very important developments in terms of technology later. And now, in terms of the specific case of constructor theory, I think the most direct technological application that could come out of it is, of course, the one that was already envisaged by the person who actually coined the term constructor, which is John von Neumann. So the reason why constructor theory is called like this is because it is intended to expand on the theory of computation, on the quantum theory of computation, in a direction that goes along with what von Neumann envisaged in the 50s. So von Neumann was this polymath who not just, he didn't just provide most of the foundational ideas about quantum theory in the modern form that we know it, but also was thinking about very visionary problems. And one of them was to have a theory of living systems in physics. And he noticed that the Turing machine, as Turing conceived of it, is universal as far as computations are concerned, but it cannot execute some transformations that are physically possible. And some of these transformations are those that the living systems actually enact. And so one of them is self-reproduction. So you can think of a cell is capable of creating a copy of itself. Now, a Turing machine like our computer, sadly, cannot be programmed to create a replica of itself. And this is not because it's ill-designed, unfortunately, but it really cannot. So in the Turing machine scheme, there is no space for a program of this kind to be executed. A Turing machine can simulate a cell undergoing self-reproduction, but it cannot itself self-reproduce. So von Neumann thought, I want to create a new machine, a more general, more powerful type of machine, and I'll call it a constructor, not a computer, but a constructor, something that can be programmed, not just to do computations, so it's not a computer, but something that can be programmed to perform constructions, physical transformations of any kind that are physically permitted under certain physical theory. And the universal constructor is the ultimate generalization of the universal Turing machine. It's a machine that can be programmed to construct anything that's physically possible. So it's like an all-powerful 3D printer, if you like, that given enough knowledge, enough, you know, smart enough program, software, can build out of raw materials anything that's physically possible. Now, the physics of Kant and Kant will provide, is kind of designed in order to provide the basics, the theory of this machine, in the same way that, you know, Turing's original theory was the underlying theoretical framework for modern computers. And so, of course, this is very far in the future, very speculative. The ultimate application of this work could be providing us with the knowledge of how to actually construct one of these machines. And this would be a fantastic boost to technology in a way that we can't even envisage. And I think David Deutsch specifically is very interested in this type of work. And I think he's developing some bits of the theory along these lines. So, you know, in a sense, watch this space. More is coming.
For sure. And this provides with so many possibilities, really. So if you were to imagine what kind of developments that could be possible in the future, what do you think you would like to see? For example, maybe more efficient solar energy harvesters or more efficient batteries?
Oh, yes. I think I think it would be very, very interesting to see how one could build machines that constructors that can self-improve improve themselves in the same way that, for example, cells, organisms have been improving themselves with natural selection. So I'd like to see what would be very interesting. This is really futuristic. It's almost sci-fi. But it would be nice to see whether you could build a generation of these constructors that are not yet universal, but when programmed with sufficient with a sufficiently good program, can then somehow undergo a spontaneous type of evolution within a certain environment and tentatively improve themselves in the same way that, say, natural selection can improve organisms with time. But natural selection is very inefficient. It would be very interesting if we could devise the process of artificial selection in a way that these nanomachines that are kind of competing with themselves within a certain environment can somehow, through this artificial selection process and also through their own interaction, provide more and more robust constructors with a slightly larger repertoire than, meaning a slightly larger set of things that they can do than what they originally began with. So it's a bit like, you know, when you look at organisms in the wild evolving from, say, bacteria to more complex structures later, which then led to the rich, you know, biosphere that we currently have. I'd love to see an actual realization of this process in some kind of artificial lab, in a way that you know, the person who created this lab actually gets surprised by the type of evolution that takes place for these programmable machines. I think we are very far from this, but I think that would be a very interesting enterprise to implement, and also for which a theory is needed. So I think this would help us also understanding better life and various aspects of living systems that currently are not understood.
So were there any discoveries along your journey to writing your book, The Science of Canon Kant, that surprised you the most?
Ah, that's a very nice question. I was surprised by the amount of unifications that you can find in different aspects of physics when you look at them from the point of view of counterfactuals. So it's very beautiful to see that, for example, you can treat classical and quantum information and also thermodynamics as emerging out of simple constraints of what you can and cannot do with certain physical systems. And so therefore, it's not just, you don't need somehow the full laws of motion of classical physics or of quantum theory like Schrödinger's equation to capture these things, but you need much less in a certain direction, much less in terms of laws of motion. You don't need all the details. And you need much more because you need to change the approach. You need to care about what can or cannot be done on a physical system rather than about what happens to the physical system given a certain trajectory it is following. So I think this is a very powerful, usually when you get, when you unify things in physics, it means that you found a regularity that is in common between different things. And this helps you describe all of these different things in a way that was invisible before you realize that they're actually all the same thing. And so in a sense, you know, this is the famous example is always Newton when he realized that the reason why the moon behaves in a certain way and the reason why the apple is falling, the reason is the same. And in that, you know, a unification on that scale is huge and is surprising and it's beautiful. And I think physics leads to such things. And in a way, the unification that I just described logically is similar in the sense that even if it's on a smaller scale, I think it's really interesting that it gives you this insight, this powerful insight in things that appear to be very different from each other, like thermodynamics, quantum information, and classical information. And instead, you can treat them all in the same way. So that was one thing. And the other thing is the fact that there can be laws that are fundamental and exact about objects that are usually regarded as macroscopic, like computers or constructors. So it's counterintuitive, and most physicists would regard this as somehow unorthodox, because you know we've been told, and it's quite beautiful, the fact that physics has moved away from, you know, anthropocentric notions through, you know, objective statements about trajectories, which don't care whether, you know, humans or other entities of that sort are around in the universe. But now it turns out that by studying things that appear to belong to the macroscopic domain, and usually these things are supposed to be, accessory and really parochial, like, as I said, computers and constructors more generally, you can uncover deep regularities that are important for understanding the fundamental laws of physics. I think this is underappreciated in the physics community, but I think we should take this on board and take it seriously more. And by the way, it's not such a new thing in a sense, because thermodynamics already showed this to us. But somehow, since when thermodynamics was proposed, we've moved away from the fact from regarding the laws of thermodynamics as fundamental, and we want to derive them from, you know, microscopic trajectories of particles. Whereas here we're saying, no, actually there's a different way of looking at the laws, which actually takes, you know, trajectories as perhaps less fundamental. And by sticking to this way, the way of counterfactuals, you can capture some phenomena that you would otherwise regard as hopelessly far from, you know, from the fundamental physics domain, while in fact they are very relevant for it, and they actually are even helpful perhaps to conjecture future laws of physics that could be the successor of quantum theory and general relativity. So it's a very, very surprising insight, I guess.
Are these the questions that get you out of the bed in the morning?
Yes, yes, absolutely. I think it's really a blessing to have, you know, it's like having a ladder constructed to go to the stars, right? So, you know, every rung is something interesting, and I think I think this is true of all intellectual activities. I don't think physics is any special in any way. When you are passionate about something, or you have some beautiful problem to contemplate, it really is like a ladder to the stars. And I think it's very nice to know that the ladder is there when you wake up in the morning, because, you know, you for sure that's an incentive to get out of bed and do something. And it's very nice. It's very beautiful. And I hope actually that most people who are involved with creative endeavors feels in the same way.
Oh, yes, for sure. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time. So what are you currently working on? And what would be your next project?
So now I am working on a number of different things. I think one important thing is this one that I mentioned earlier. We would like to have a connection between these principles of the science of Kant and Kant and some direct experimental prediction. So I'm working with also some students of mine in Oxford on finding an interesting application within thermodynamics. And this is work I've been doing with Maria Violaris. And then I'm trying to find also a kind of interesting application within the context of this experiment that I mentioned on quantum effects in gravity. So this is something I'm doing with Vlatko Vedro and a student of mine who's called Simone Rijavec. And finally, I'm trying to somehow guess also some better mathematical formulation for some of these ideas within constructive theory, within the science of Kant and Kant. And this is something I'm doing with another student of mine. It's called Niceto Tibau Vidal. So I think, you know, this is like takes up a lot of my time right now. And then I'm trying to find new problems. So I think it would be very nice to be able to apply this these new ideas of constructive theory to new issues. And one of these issues which is interesting is how to understand clocks and time within the science of Kant and Kant, because these principles that I talked about counterfactuals, don't mention clocks or dynamics explicitly. They don't have motion in them, they're timeless. And yet we would like to be able to express clocks and dynamics within the science of Kant and Kant. So I think this is another side project that I'm doing with David. And then aside from that, I think physicists always read a lot. So I'm trying to read as many interesting things as I can. So that's where we get usually inspiration by you know, poking here and there things that maybe we're not really working on actively, but we just find fascinating. And so I'm kind of looking for the next nice problem to address in this vast set of things that I'm not yet completely aware of. So I think this is what I'm doing right now.
This sounds super interesting. So where can our listeners find more information about your work and also your book?
So I think there are two websites. One is chiaramaletto.com, which is my personal website. And then there is constructivetheory.org, which is a website dedicated to this particular project with a lot of material that I gathered along the way, with lots of interviews to my collaborators, also to myself, and some didactic material also for those who are not maybe physicists, but they're interested in hearing about these ideas in a more informal way. And always, you know, writing an email is always possible. So my email is chiara.marletto@gmail.com, and I'm always happy to reply to questions.
And the book?
The book is described and advertised on both of these websites. And so I think that and Penguin website is also another good website for looking up my book and information about it. There are some nice podcasts on the internet, which you can find. I think you can sort of look up some of these kind of nice various podcasts that have been created about my book. One of them is by Brett Hall. So there's a nice description of some of the chapters of the book if you're interested in that. And there's also an audiobook if you're not into reading, but you prefer to listen, that's also possible.
Excellent. Well, I'd like to thank you for joining us today. It has been truly illuminating discussion, and I learned a lot.
Same here. Thank you very much for having me. It was wonderful. Thank you.